Zero, Craig B. Holdfast Incorporated, HSS.
Keter?
Keter.
Yes, Your Honor.
How's that called?
Keter.
Keter.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Rule 56 requires that a district court draw all factual inferences in favor of the party opposing a motion for summary judgment. In this case, the district court did just the opposite of what the Rule 56 requires, and this set the stage for committing reversible error. Here's what happened. The three patents that were before the district court on the summary judgment motion were all cited by the examiner during the course of examination of the Craig patent
suit. Counsel, Netterfeld, am I saying that right?
I think so, Your Honor.
Netterfeld, okay. How did Netterfeld come to be before the PTO during prosecution? Was it disclosed by the applicant, the 10-year-old whiz kid, or was it found by the examiner?
It was cited by the examiner.
Don't you think that's evidence of analogous art, the fact that the examiner located in his search with regard to this particular invention, this piece of prior art, and included it in his search report?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think there are a couple of inferences that can be drawn from the fact that he saw the patent, but he did not apply it. The shrimp was the primary reference.
But that gets into a different question, okay, which is the identification of what's disclosed in the patent and its application. Certainly, an examiner wouldn't generally identify as part of his search and then list on the front face of the patent a bunch of irrelevant pieces of material that he happened to come upon, right? I mean, clearly, when an examiner does a search and then identifies the relevant documents that he says he considers in allowance of this patent, why is that not evidence that those documents are analogous art, or at least that the examiner thought they were? Whether they are or not is another question, but at least the examiner.
Only because, Your Honor, he would have had the opportunity to combine it with another reference, but he did not. So he didn't view it sufficiently pertinent or analogous to.
But counsel, don't you agree that examiners turn up on their search and report an awful lot of documents on the front face of patents, so they don't actually cite those, every single one of them?
That's correct.
In conjunction with a reference. In fact, 99% of the ones they identify don't end up getting cited, right? But they're nonetheless put into the patent prosecution history as having been reviewed relevant to this patent.
That's correct. And there were a lot more patents than just these three that were cited also. There were several others.
But don't we have a prior case that actually suggests that the fact that it was cited during prosecution is relevant to an assessment of whether it's analogous arts? I think Union Carbide is, am I remembering the case right? Are you familiar with that one?
I suspect it's in the brief, Your Honor, and I'm familiar with it. But I don't think that if it were relevant, that he should have applied it, and the fact that he did, and I think the inference that could be drawn was that he did not view it sufficiently pertinent.
So then you're back to where we started. You think examiners frequently list and identify from the results of their search a bunch of irrelevant material?
I think they cite, based on my experience, they will cite other patents for the purpose of for whatever they're worth, so to speak. But if they're really pertinent, they will combine them with the other references and make it obvious as a rejection. As I say, there were other patents cited here, including mechanical shirt folding devices that weren't applied to the claim, but were cited as part of the prior art that he searched. He searched for devices.
And you certainly don't dispute that all of those are within the relevant field and therefore analogous arts.
Pardon?
You don't dispute that all of those, the mechanical shirt folding patents that you're referring to, are within the relevant field and therefore analogous arts.
I think they were. They dealt with shirt folding devices. I think what he did here is he did not have a reference that taught a one-piece member that would be capable of folding a shirt, and so therefore he went outside of what was the actual field of endeavor of the inventor and looked to see if he could find it someplace else, and they found it.
But that's because it's a two-part test, right? I mean, you would acknowledge that in
right.
McClay and other cases, the bars have established analogous arts is not just in the same field. That would make it a lot easier, of course.
Sure.
But that it also involves identifying the same problem or focusing on the same problem the inventor was trying to solve.
Well, that's right. And he went outside of the field. He went into another classification, actually, and looked to see if he could find something there that might have been cross-referenced, that might, some folding device that might have been cross-referenced for purposes of folding garments. He had them, and he didn't combine them. And I think the inference that can be drawn is that he didn't view them as sufficiently pertinent as to be able to be fairly combined, what to make a 103 obviousness of rejection.
Or the other inference could also be that he did not need that reference to establish a rejection. That there was sufficient part brought in by the search, that the entire search results did not need to be brought together.
That's true.
So that's the other inference. It's the opposite inference of what you're arguing, isn't it?
Right, but and the point I was making here, the inference that the court drew, I mean, there were two basic inferences I think that have been drawn from this fact. One is that they're looking at the inference in the light most favorable to Craig. It was that the sunshade patents weren't pertinent, and that's why they weren't combined. The other inference, which is the one that's least favorable to Craig, and this is the one that the court drew, is that they were pertinent, but the examiner didn't do his job and make a 103 obviousness rejection in the patent office. So I think that the Rule 56 required the court to draw all disputed factual inferences in the light most favorable to Craig, and here he did, and then proceeded then to look at these automobile windshield sunshade patents and fabricate formulate a 103 basis for holding that the claim 5 was obvious. I think what happened here is when the court looked at it, at the references, he first of all, he correctly recognized that they weren't within the inventor's field of endeavor, clearly outside of the field of endeavor. And so he then looked at the advantages of the Craig invention, and he looked at the advantages of the Netherveld patent, and he inferred a commonality of purpose of the of these two inventions. And I think what happened here is that the error stemmed from his characterization of the Craig patent as, quote, evidencing an attempt to create a simple and inexpensive folding device. And then he characterized the Netherveld patent as having as one of its goals to, quote, to create a foldable ... device, which is of simple and inexpensive construction. And then he looked at these advantages of these two references, and he inferred a common purpose or problem to be solved, that is, quote, to provide a simple and inexpensive foldable device. And I think that's incorrect. The problem that confronted Craig was to create a device for folding a t-shirt. And for that purpose, he made the structure of Claim 5. And that had the advantages of being simple and inexpensive. The problem confronting Netherveld was to create a device that could reflect the sun's rays when it's deployed inside of an automobile windshield. Netherveld's device only needed to fold compact for storage and to deploy in an erect configuration to reflect the sun's rays. But it also had the advantages of being simple and inexpensive. Now, what happened is the court the purposes were different, and they accomplished their different purposes by means of different structures that operated in different environments. By the courts considering the advantages that Craig and Netherveld had in common and ascribing to them commonality of purpose, I think that that's where he went wrong, and he should have combined their respective purposes by looking at their structures that were used to accomplish their respective advantages. In addition,
is that really a restriction as to going to the purposes requirement? I mean, if you take a look, basically, at the patents that were cited, you could almost make an anticipation rejection based on truck alone. Because basically the only difference there is the folding aspects of it, the hinges. So you replace the hinges with the crease.
Right.
That's almost an anticipation. It comes very close to an anticipation rejection.
Well, Your Honor, that's...
It's very, very close. So when you start saying that everything needs to have a purpose tie-in,
well, the thing is, shrimp is is for fully full-size garments, and there's an extra panel in there also. So in order to modify the shred, you'd have to cut the lower panel off for one thing. But we have an element in Claim 5 calls for the device to be dimensional for receiving a t-shirt. Clearly, we're talking about a much smaller member. And the word member in Claim 5 also defines the structure as being a one-piece structure.
Counsel, I don't want to get off track, so just correct me if I'm wrong. I thought that that pretty much everyone acknowledged that the only difference between shrimp and Claim 5 of the asserted patent is the use of creases rather than hinges.
Not entirely, Your Honor. If you look at the second, the limitation in Claim 5, which was not even mentioned.
Said member being dimensionally.
Said member being dimensionally receiving a t-shirt.
But was that something that the district court found and was argued below? Because I saw the entire focus of the briefs to be on the creases versus hinges.
Well, that's what the district court focused on, but the district court never even mentioned a limitation B. It's not mentioned in the opinion at all. And
But in effect, isn't it mentioned? Because I believe the district court very clearly said the only thing missing from the shrimp patent is. The creases rather than using hinges. So clearly the district court seemed to think every other element of Claim 5 was present in shrimp. Did you argue for the district court element B?
We have all of the elements. You have to look at the invention as a whole
No, of course, but did you argue that shrimp did not sufficiently disclose a t-shirt dimensionally sized device for receiving t-shirts?
That I can't recall, Your Honor.
You all consider on appeal new issues not raised below. And so I think I'm just trying to bring us back to focus. I understood the only issue before us to be whether the district court properly combined Netterbell and Shrimp. Netterbell providing the creases and Shrimp providing everything else.
No, I'm quite certain, Your Honor, that I'd have to look in the brief in opposition. I'm quite certain we raised that in the opposition brief in the court below. But you have to look at all of the limitations in the claim, and that being a member, not a series of members connected together by separate hinges, and that had to be dimensional for receiving a t-shirt. I would just have to look through my brief as to where I might find that.
Let's hear it from the other side now. Let's hear it from the other side now. You can look while you're waiting for your rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. I'm here for Foldfast and HSN. I think I have the luxury of sitting over there. I have the answer to your question. At A111, the shrimp patent discusses it as a means of folding and pressing knit good garments such as underwear. It fits a t-shirt. It just fits other longer, larger garments as well.
And the district court held, am I remembering correctly, the district court held Shrimp disclose everything except for creases and hinges and sort of combined Netterbell.
Correct. And I would remind the panel that we had a Markman hearing here, and we got into the prosecution history, and the district court held that by virtue of the prosecution history, hinges were not covered by the Craig patent, which is significant if we ever go back down because we have an integral molded hinge and won't be found to infringe. That having been said, the prosecution history is important here as well, because if you follow the trail of it, you have an examiner looking at this patent application.
But counsel, the examiner never cited Netterbell. I'm going to go right to the heart of whether or not Netterbell is analogous arts, if you don't mind. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Okay. And the examiner never actually cited Netterbell, correct? It was just listed as one of the things he found in conjunction with the search.
Netterbell appears for the first time after the applicant avoids the shrimp rejection for anticipation. He avoids it by saying, it's my simplicity. It's these creases. And when that happens, the examiner comes back and says, notice of allowability, notice of cited references, and lists and closes that. You can see he checks the box down on the bottom that says, I'm enclosing the notice of cited references. And that's where Netterbell and Signer show up.
So the examiner
first
identified or found Netterbell as part of the search when he was reviewing applicant's response to the initial rejection.
When he reacted to the applicant's statement that we're different because we're so simple.
But you wouldn't suggest that merely being disclosed in a search report, kind of as I was with appellant's counsel, you wouldn't suggest that that necessarily means it's analogous arts, would you?
I don't think that it necessarily does, because I don't think we're really, you're really bound by what the examiner did or thought here. I think what
but you wouldn't necessarily say that leads to, the reason I stumbled with this is because clearly we have held that even disclosure on the front face of the patent being considered by the examiner doesn't actually make something prior art, because sometimes the patent office can identify things and consider them and it turns out they weren't even prior art. So it seems to me that we can't really go with the notion that it was before the examiner, meaning it's necessarily analogous.
I don't think that's dispositive. I think you go to the face of these patents and you look at how Siegler and Netterveld both said simplicity, inexpensive folding device. And what we have here is someone who's trying to make shrimp, and we're going to presume that the person of ordinary skill in the art knows about shrimp. They've stipulated that it's analogous. So if you put shrimp in front of me and say, make that inexpensively, make that simply, what do? I do exactly what Jason Craig did. I walk into my garage and I look at a classic example of the prior art of folded cardboard, a cardboard box, and I break it down and I use its folds and I make shrimp in a folding, inexpensive item. It's an obvious combination. I think there's a visceral appeal here to the fact that anybody who had shrimp in front of them and who wanted to do something inexpensive for a fifth grade science project would go into their garage and get some folding cardboard. I think that it is obvious to the point that it's outside of the realm of how that word has been used historically in the patent cases of this court. It's just obvious. And I think the district court looked at the...
But isn't that something that maybe should have been decided by a jury?
I don't think so, because I think you look at the text, just like in Chortum. I think this is Chortum, where you had a summary judgment decision, and the court said, we can look at the text of these patents, we can look at the illustrations, and we can see from them that this is pertinent, this is relevant art, and move straight through the stages and said, for the other criteria, we don't have to look at an expert's testimony as to whether this would be obvious, and we don't have to look at evidence of ordinary skill, because the bare minimum level of skill, if you take the presumption that the inventor dealing with this problem is presumed to know of the prior art, is presumed to know of shrimp, as they've stipulated, then I think you are forced to come to the conclusion that this is an obvious combination that produces predictable results. Using folded cardboard to create shrimp is going to create a lightweight, inexpensive, and this is how, I want to go back to the prosecution history.
This is not how the district court came to conclusions. What you seem to want me to do is to find that shrimp and the knowledge of one skilled in the art would be enough to render this obvious. But that's not what the district court found on summary judgment. The district court found, didn't it, that Netterveld plus shrimp rendered it obvious. Isn't that what's really in front of us?
I think that's how he got there, because that's what was in front of him. He looked at the Netterveld patent. He said, this is pertinent because under Clay, under Paulson, it deals with the same problem the inventor expressly states in his prosecution, expressly states in his patent that he was dealing with.
Well, what was the problem he was dealing with? I thought it was to find a way to fold shirts.
If he would have you define the problem by going to the field of endeavor, because he doesn't like that second prong of Clay, which says if it's not in the field of endeavor, you can go to someone who's solving the problem. And the problem that he, in the prosecution history, to avoid that shrimp rejection, the problem that he told the examiner he was dealing with was simplicity, inexpensiveness. And that comes right out on the face of his patent, as it does with Siegler and
Netterveld. That would mean that everything that is simple and inexpensive would therefore be analogous arts, clearly. I mean, you can't cast the net that broadly.
Folding devices, folding cardboard, patents that say simple, inexpensive, folding devices.
So greeting cards, prior art, analogous?
To this? No, I don't think it's a folding device.
What? Greeting cards fold in half?
They're folding things, but they're not devices. I don't think that's a fair use of the term device. A device is a functional thing. A folding card is a piece of folded paper, but I think we don't need to go there.
The sunscreen's not much different from a big greeting card, is it? I mean, it just folds in thirds. At least the one I have in the minivan does. So, it just folds in thirds instead of halves. So, and it's made out of material that isn't much different, it seems to me,
If you define the problem he was dealing with as folding garments, you've eliminated the second prong of Clay. Because you said, go back to the field of endeavor.
Okay, so what should the second prong focus on? Because what I'm concerned about is not just the implication for your case, but obviously what we say about that second prong is going to have some impact beyond just your case. So how would you say we should be defining the second prong of Clay?
If you, I don't think we have to issue an opinion on Clay. I think this case is governed by Clay and Paulson, but I think that what you do is you go look at what Craig wrote in the beginning of his patent, how important it was for folding devices, for the low margin operators to be inexpensive and easy to make. And you look at that and you recognize that what he's telling you is the problem that he was attempting to solve was something lighter, something easier, something cheaper than shrimp. Because as your honor said, they've got an anticipation problem over
so
the shrimp
as
well.
So is the problem, when Clay says focus on the problem the inventor is trying to solve, is it, okay, is this how we should think about approaching it? Look at the prior art, and what is the problem, what is the inventor trying to do beyond the prior art? Because that seems to be the focus that you're telling me to take. Look at shrimp. You've got shrimp. What are you trying to do? You're trying to make shrimp, but make it cheaper and simpler.
Okay.
So is that, I'm just trying to understand how to apply this test.
Right. Look at Paulson. Paulson has a laptop, okay, a computer laptop case. They said, go outside of the field of endeavor, forget about laptops, forget about calculators, forget about that. What we're talking about here is the means of causing that top to fold over and rotate. And that is washing machines and cabinets and all of that. I'm sorry? Yes, all of that's analogous because it is a means of making that fold over. And if Paulson's right, then Judge Moore, no relation I assume, but Judge Moore is right below that this use of folding cardboard to make an inexpensive and simple shrimp is an obvious combination to yield predictable results. I would say the visceral component is there. We have not gone beyond pertinent, and I don't know whether I've satisfied your concerns or can't, but I do not want to neglect the rest since this is my only chance and I have 5 minutes left and then I have to sit down. I want to talk about secondary considerations because I think there are four things that they put before the district court. I don't think any of them worked to it. He won an award in a science contest. He got his name in the paper. He got on a television show. I don't believe that's commercial success. I think that's what happens when a 10-year-old does something clever. But I don't think clever and patentable are the same thing. I think for purposes of this, a 10-year-old, I can think you can set the bar right down there at the layman level, and I think 10-year-olds are laymen. So if that answers your question, I don't think that we're looking at people who are at DuPont. That's probably an archaic reference. I don't even keep up with DuPont. But in any event, the other two items were a license, which by the record evidence undisputed, was canceled for lack of a market.
But we didn't get into all that.
Okay. I just don't want to come back and get you from behind. But, I think during the opening we spoke specifically, I think the conversation was limited to the issue of what was pertinent and analogous. And again, I think this is chore time. I think you can even disregard that the examiner cited these references, although I think that Boltress is it. I think you look at the face of the patent and you see what these applicants and patentees said they were trying to do. And I don't believe that recitation of the Graham factors or saying there's a dispute as to material facts creates a dispute. The patents that the court was considering were in front of them. The text is black and white. The drawings are black and white. You can look at them and see what was going on there. And you can come to the conclusion without making, invading the province of the jury, that a person of ordinary skill in the art, presuming that he knows what the pertinent art was, could have combined these and achieved predictable results. And I think that's what Judge Moore concluded after looking at all of this. I don't think he made fact findings. I think he recognized undisputed facts. And I think his result is correct and should be affirmed. And I'll yield the balance of my time.
Your Honor, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said how broadly do we open the net to pick up prior art. We have to look at the structure and function and not advantages. For instance, in the KSR case, the Supreme Court talked about Asada would not have involved Engel's goal of making a small, simple, and inexpensive pedal. I mean, I have been practicing for 40-some years. I've never seen an inventor set out to make something complex and expensive in any pad. So that's a general goal of everything, and I think you're right on the money with respect to that observation.
Do you agree with Mr. Woods that the Trump covered the element B you were talking about when you sat down?
You were going to look into that.
I couldn't find it in my brief where I'd raised it. Frankly, there were so many problems that I had with
the motion. Do you agree with that?
Pardon?
He gave us an answer when he came up.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I was probably, unfortunately, busy looking for what I was trying to find. The other problem I had with this case was there's such a paucity of evidence that was presented. There was no evidence as to the level of ordinary skill in the art which would enable the district court to reach its conclusion on obviousness. With respect to the secondary consideration evidence, there were a number of items. He imposed a burden that I've never heard of in the law. I mean, there's got to be a nexus between the invention and the secondary consideration evidence. But here, he seemed to have said that that was not.
I didn't let him into it. You didn't get there in the beginning. It was sort of what you're responding to his argument.
All right. Well, I just respectfully, don't believe that what the district court did was comply with Rule 56. I don't believe the motion made out a prima facie case, but didn't present enough evidence from which the district court could make a proper determination of obviousness based on undisputed facts. And for that reason, I believe it should be reversed. In addition, the case has just recently been published in the United States Patents Quarterly, so it's being viewed by a number of patent lawyers, and the citation for that is, I'm going to give the court, is that 85 USPQ 1470 was published on the 11th of February of this year. So I believe that the case was wrongly decided and really needs to be reversed. Thank you.
All rise.